This is OPB News. I'm Christian Foden-Wenzel. This week, the presidential candidates continue fighting hard for votes in states like Indiana and North Carolina. Oregon's primary is May 20th. The deadline to register to vote is tomorrow. As voters get to know the contenders for president, we present three stories outlining positions taken by Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John McCain on environmental issues. April Baer has our first report on how each campaign comes down on forest management and timber.
The beauty of living in Oregon is that you're never far away from the serenity of wildland. Even the most citified Portlanders can glance up and see the federally protected beauty of Mount Hood. You can't possibly drive across central or eastern Oregon without hitting federal forest land. And many valley towns like Eugene and Corvallis lie just on the edge of national forests.
This is the base of Mary's Peak, not too far from Corvallis. It's so still here. Even the birds sound kind of quiet. They're so far up in the canopy.
Forest is not something that's just remote and out there. I mean, a lot of us live close to it, and a lot of us live in it.
Dan Donato is a research associate at the Forest Science Department at Oregon State University. He predicts the next president will have to confront wildland conflicts. It's been about 15 years since the federal government last attempted a major mediation with the Northwest Forest Plan. Since then, Donato says many forest issues remain unresolved, like lackluster timber harvests and declining forest health. And, of course, the question of what to do about Oregon wildfires.
I think that awareness has evolved quite a bit. I mean, I think when a lot of the public is thinking about forestry issues now, they're thinking about fire.
Donato should know. Last year, he authored a study on salvage logging in places where wildfires have burned. His data questioned whether logging is always beneficial. The debate that followed turned vicious. Even Congress got involved. While forest issues are of utmost importance in the West, there hasn't been much talk about them among the presidential contenders. Until last week. Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton was the first to break the silence.
Well, what Senator Clinton has proposed is to actually increase employment in the woods while protecting the areas that Oregonians care the most about.
Josh Carden speaks for Clinton's Oregon campaign office. Last week, in her so-called Oregon Compact, Clinton laid out her plans. She says she'd ban cutting in all of the state's remaining old-growth forests and keep roadless areas roadless. She's also proposing more federal protections for Mount Hood and parts of eastern and southern Oregon. Carden says that Clinton wants to extend timber payments to counties where logging has died out and create new jobs to thin overgrown forests.
We can do something about fire. We can make the federal government a far better neighbor to private landowners. And we can put a lot of people back to work.
Hillary Clinton's proposals will sound familiar for anyone who remembers President Bill Clinton's years in the White House and his work on the Northwest Forest Plan. The senator from New York has been careful to include provisions that both environmental groups and some wood products companies covet. Clinton has no close ties to timber, but has voted for certain business and trade laws that these companies favor. She's generally well-liked by conservation groups she's worked with in New York, and has voted with other Democrats against Alaskan oil drilling and other hot-button issues. As for Republican Senator John McCain, his campaign hasn't said much about forest issues in recent months. Our request for an interview went unanswered, but McCain is one of a few candidates with a trackable record. In recent years, he's generally voted yes on bills that favor the timber industry, with a few notable exceptions, like his no vote on the Bush Energy Bill and a yes vote to ratify the Kyoto Treaty. McCain opposed roadless rules drafted by the Clinton administration in 2001. Conservationists certainly welcome his vote, but they rarely count on it. As the junior senator from Arizona, McCain has sometimes deferred to his colleague, Senator John Kyle, who's been much more influential in forest policy. Back in 2002, McCain did work across the aisle with some Democrats to come up with compromises as Congress was considering the Healthy Forests Bill. His plan was one of several snubbed by the Republican leadership. Sifting three senators' records for trace elements of forest policies can get frustrating. It's worth remembering that some forest conflicts have boggled Oregon's best minds for years.
How can you have a candidate that has personal experience with everything that's going to be on a president's place? They just can't.
Joe Bowersox is a professor of environmental policy at Willamette University. He's also spent time on Capitol Hill, working on forest issues for Senator Ron Wyden.
we only have 100 senators, and senators have to have kind of broad purview over many different policies. They themselves maybe only specialize in one or two policies.
Except when they're running for president. Which brings us to Democratic Senator Barack Obama. With one foot in urban Chicago and another in the Midwest heartland, he's been working hard to prove his grasp on Western issues. Obama gets very high marks from green groups in his home state of Illinois, but most agree that he hasn't been around long enough to deal with forest issues in detail. His campaign has focused on one central message, Obama's potential as a consensus builder. His environmental advisor, Dan Kamen, can be seen in several YouTube clips, like this one, talking about how the senator would unite different regions, in this case, for a national policy on global warming.
That's going to take a leader who inspires people and gets places like Mississippi to say, well, this is the sort of person I could vote for, as well as the Californians. And Obama is the only one on either side who can carry that kind of momentum.
In response to a request for interview, the Obama campaign submitted a statement that outlined plans for forest fire prevention. The campaign promises to bolster a forest service decimated by years of neglect and to seek a, quote, long-term solution for counties suffering without timber revenue. The Obama camp also promises plans to pay landowners for carbon sequestration, a very trendy topic in conservation circles right now. Timber industry scorecards give Obama a thumbs up for approving some land sales and the Bush energy bill, thumbs down for Obama's no votes on domestic oil development and tax and trade issues. No election year discussion of forest issues is complete without consideration of economic problems in timber country. This sawmill in Independence is just one example. Boise Cascade closed it down last year, taking about 30 jobs from a town that needed them. Hear that? It's almost as silent as the forest. Opinions vary about whether Oregon's timber industry can ever regain its powerhouse status. But as voters of all stripes survey two Democrats and one Republican this spring, it's likely they'll be listening for more than just green words. April Baer, OPB News.
Government seismologists have raised their estimate for how much the West Coast will shake when the big one hits. The scientists agree there's a higher probability the offshore Cascadia earthquake zone will rupture all at once from Vancouver Island to Northern California. That would unleash a massive magnitude 9 earthquake and probably a tsunami as well. The updated earthquake hazard map was discussed at a national conference that wrapped up in Seattle this weekend. Scientists and emergency planners there also pondered legends gathered from coastal Indian tribes. Correspondent Tom Bonsi filed this report about how those native stories are being incorporated into earthquake and tsunami preparedness plans.
Native Americans were the only ones here the last time the big one hit. It happened in the year 1700. Catastrophe struck at least a half dozen other times over the millennia before. Native storytellers incorporated those events into myths and legends that are being mined for details today. At the earthquake conference, researcher Ruth Ludwin of Seattle shared a story from the Northwest Coast. It describes a terrible battle between the Thunderbird and the whale.
That at the time the Thunderbird fought the whale, there was a shaking and a jumping up and a trembling of the earth beneath and a rolling up of the great waters.
Ludwin says some variations of the story include details that correlate with geologic evidence, for example, of prairies that flooded or encampments wiped out. Oral history also fascinates earthquake and tsunami planner George Crawford at Washington State's Emergency Management Division. He noticed that some of the native stories convey advice about running to higher ground after an earthquake. A light bulb went off. Crawford sensed an opportunity to enhance preparedness outreach.
Science is one thing, but if you could back it up with somebody actually been there or somebody's father or mother has gone through that venture, you relate to that.
Crawford's agency collaborated with a storyteller from the Ho tribe named Viola Reby. They made an educational DVD using kind of an amalgam story. In it, a young boy warns his village to evacuate ahead of a tsunami.
All the people stood there looking at their destroyed village, stunned at how quickly it had happened. they realized they could have all...
George Crawford says the Native American story is a big hit. 15,000 to 20,000 DVDs have been passed out.
When you're on the coast and the ground shakes like it did in Obie's story, you must remember to...
run to high ground.
That's right.
Along California's Redwood Coast, National Park Service geologist Vicky Ozaki is also working with communities on tsunami and earthquake preparedness. Ozaki says some Yurok tribal members initially said they didn't want to talk about disasters because speaking too much about it might invite catastrophe. But the ancient legends may offer a way to get around that.
There are some wonderful oral histories off the mouth of the Klamath that describe the ocean receding past Mile Rock and fish flopping around on the ocean floor and talking about signals that would tell the tribes to go to high ground.
Ozaki has asked permission to use those stories for public education. I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
Five years ago, Nevada transplants John and Judy Stewart bought an 82-acre farm near Newburgh. They grow grass seed, but this is not really a regular farm. For example, the couple have turned their grain silos into bed and breakfast rooms and filled the grounds with chickens, llamas, goats, and ducks. Now John is sprucing up an old horse barn into a place to taste wines. He's also installing a bizarre new machine that allows enophiles to sample any of 56 bottles of locally grown wine without having to worry about the wine spoiling before the next customer wants a sip. I met with him in the barn and asked him about his plans.
Well, it's a terribly long story, but made mercifully short. What we've done is moved from our home in Las Vegas, Nevada, about 5 years ago, with a scope of project intended to revitalize and reinvent an old family farm. The idea really being to reutilize existing resources and capture the spirit of the agricultural terrain and the beauty of the area, and at the same time take facilities that are otherwise pretty dilapidated and not in use anymore and restructure them in a fashion that would enable us an economic enterprise that would be sustainable, and sustainable defined differently than it used to be, wherein in the old days, sustainability typically meant you grew animals and crops and you ate them, quite frankly. And nowadays, sustainability warrants a new definition. Somebody's got to pay the light bills here, so we mean economic sustainability.
So I understand you have some kind of newfangled machine that serves wine. Apparently pouring a bottle's not good enough. Tell me, what is it?
Well, this is a system that was put in play a number of years ago in Italy, as a matter of fact, and it's called the Enomatic system, invented by a fellow named Riccardo Gossi. The system enables both the preservation and dispensing of wine in an automated type of format and fashion. It utilizes an inert gas, argon gas, to displace oxygen in the bottle, thereby preserving the wine. It also uses the argon to pressurize and then extract the wine from the bottle in exact one-ounce pours. Ours is a tasting facility specifically.
So the idea is that you can go down a wall of bottles and pick ones that you want, and you just have a very small drink and just see whether you like that particular wine or not.
That's precisely the idea. There are limitations to that. Being as we are a tasting room and we're very compliance-oriented, we want only to have people have access to, of the 56 wines, they may only have up to 10 tastes in any two-hour period of time.
I was going to ask about the other wineries. Are they worried that you're kind of making a grab for the vineyard visitor business, or is it different?
Well, I really can't speak for all of them, but we would hope that they would understand exactly what we are trying to do. And we're telling each of them individually our story, which is to say we want to platform the experience in the wine country, be the first stop. As we can help people understand what it is they like, we can then guide them to the wineries. So, in fact, candidly, we think that they're going to gather that much more business as a result of our interplay into the process.
So the idea being that you go along a few of those 56 bottles you see on the wall and you take a drink of one or two that you really like, and then you can then go to that winery and see and meet the winemaker and see the fields for yourself.
That's exactly it. In fact, we augment by giving people kind of a scorecard, and we let them speak with our sommelier on staff and go back and forth to discern what it is they like, understand the culture of the wine country itself at large, be introduced de facto to the winemakers and their thoughts, because each one of the wines will have a description produced by the winemaker as to what characteristics you should be looking for, and he's trying to impart with his individual, or her, I should say, individual stylings.
All right. Well, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you for visiting with us.
John Stewart is eyeing yet another barn at Abbey Road Farm with a view to perhaps turning it into a riding arena where he can hold everything from a horse show to a hoedown.